Welcome to a brand new Amash program. You're in for an interesting ride. This is the Amash Files, hosted by PeoplesInternetRadio.com.
Hello and welcome to the Amash Files, and thank you to People's Internet Radio and Vin and Neon Machine for all your tech support supporting me tonight. I really hope that I'm going to have some very exciting and interesting things to share with you folks. And first of all, I'm just going to talk about the name Amash. Apparently in Irish it's Amach. Well, Amash stands for something, and it means anomalous mind management abductee contactee helpline. And it's a project, so it's the Amash project, which was born on the 23rd of January 2011. Now, the reason I've chosen that word, and it's come out as Amash, actually, interestingly enough, I'm told very much authoritatively by Vin that it means out in Irish, and that is it. It really is about out of the box thinking, and out of the closet for our experiences. And I'm going to tell you all about that in a moment. But first of all, I'd just like to say that my two guests tonight, I'm really excited to have on board. That's Simon Parks, who's from Whitby in North Yorkshire, an elected Labour councillor, and Ray Hernandez from Miami, Florida. And we'll be speaking to him in the second half. But just before we start on all of that, I just want to tell you about what I saw this evening in the night skies. In taking my little doggy Jacques for a walk, I'm always craning my neck forward, ever forward, to see if I can really see anything, because I'm not an experiencer. So I don't have that inside information, but I do have the empathy, and I'm an avid compulsive researcher in the field of all things alternative. So with my head craned skywards, I looked to see if I could see what my lovely friend up in the Arctic Circle, David Monroe, calls a mover, and indeed I did. I saw this little guy who looked like a star moving along at a fair pace, let me tell you, and it couldn't have been a satellite, because satellites don't do that. The Earth revolves around them. So this little guy was going along the same trajectory. Now, I'm in the southeast of the UK, so it was coming from the sea area, heading, I guess, northeast. And I just mention this because this seems to be a regular route. And one of the very interesting things that I was able to see was one of the compatriots of our host, Vin, in Ireland, a guy called Eamon Ansborough, who's an astronomer. When I was invited to speak at the Irish UFO conference in 2009, I met Eamon, and he showed myself, Grant Cameron, and one or two others some of the work that he'd been doing. And what he'd been doing was observing. He was doing this in the Boyle area. He was observing these movers, UFOs, whatever you want to call them. And what he noticed, that there was a set pattern from what he could tell, and he'd set up a way to catalogue this and to mark out, and it showed a grid pattern, and he in fact was feeding this through into the European Space Agency. So I don't know what's come of all of that research and information, but the fact that there is somebody out there who's already logging and tracking UFOs in this way, I think is very interesting. So it's all part of the work of Amash, which is updating. It's really inclusive. And the area of the experiencer, and I'll just define what that is. The experiencer is that umbrella term used to denote someone who's had contact, or in a different way, contact face-to-face, contact consensual, or contact as in an abduction experience, which is, as it sounds, an abduction. It's non-consensual as far as they're aware at the time. There may be sole agreements in place, and we can talk about that another time or later in the show. But so experiencer is this umbrella term, and AMASH really was developed over years of research and interest in the field. And my initial training was in performance, theatre arts, production, something in television, all the rest of that. And it all seems to have come and anchored in AMASH, because one of the things I want to do is get this stuff out there, get discussion and debate, and to look at this seriously. Because let me tell you, folks, for those who have never had an experience, and I am one of those, but I do come from an awareness of compassion, and this is what we need, kindness and compassion in bringing knowledge and awareness and questions to this whole field, is to understand that this can be quite, whilst it's a spiritual experience, definitely on one side, can also be a deeply traumatizing process. And if you are someone who has had experiences over a lifetime and have become isolated or ostracized even from your kith, kin, society, people have lost marriages and jobs. They've lost their whole life as they know it because a phenomena has occurred for which society as yet has no formal structure to explain it or support. So in seeing this and having spoken to people about their experiences, I could see that certainly in the UK, there was no specific area of support. There are people who get together now and again, and I know that there's Dave Hodrian in Birmingham who hosts BUFOG, which is a Birmingham UFO group, and he has an experience, a chat room on his site from time to time. I think it may be twice monthly. So are these pockets here and there, but there isn't anything sort of nationally that could address this and bring in and be a point of focus for people, where people would have a safe, unjudgmental, listening, empathetic body to listen to or to listen to them. And this is so important because, as far as I'm concerned, these folks are at the coalface of this phenomena, of this experience, and they have some very, very important stuff that we need to hear, we need to understand, because it's clear that something is engaging humanity and has been doing so for eons. And perhaps for the first time in our consciousness, we are at a stage of awareness where we can consciously engage with these others. Now, there are thousands of these other species, I believe, out there. But it seems that humanity is being engaged by perhaps a faction, a certain faction and fraction of them, and we'll come into that later on. But going back to AMASH and its root, the helpline is dedicated. I run this on Fresh Air, by the way, folks. I'm not paid. This is totally voluntary stuff. And I just feel that it is so important, and this is a social event, this is a social movement, and I'm really not being too strong when I say that. I really mean this, because I think that knowledge and information that will come from this field, when it is taken and understood in the scientific, academic, and then cascaded down through society, at the moment it's grassroots and coming up. We need to meet in that middle, and we need to harness the information that's coming from that, and you will hear about some of that as we go along from my guests. So we need a sensible, down-to-earth, compassionate, kindly look into this field. And it's a field, as you all will know, that draws a lot of ridicule, a lot of derision, and endless jokes. And, you know, that's fine. But then we need to get to know what this is really all about. So that's why AMASH was born, to really address a bit of a vacuum and to give people a safe place. And, you know, AMASH is only 3 years old. We'll be four in January. But in its short life, a lot has happened. And one of the things that happened was that at our very first meeting, which was in a Masonic hall in Nottingham, and I'm sure we brought a bit of light to that area. I had Simon as one of my first speakers, and the whole A thing behind the Amash thing is getting people to identify with their experience, if possible. Now, what I mean by that is to put your face and your name to your experience and to have the courage to come forward. And let me tell you, that is not easy. Not when you have to make a living, not when you have to be identified in your community, not when you have a family, and all the rest of that to feed into. It's really, really tough, and I really want to kind of bring that point home, because the people who do come forward to me and allow me to interview them and allow, whether it's face-to-face or whether they want to do it anonymously, it doesn't matter, but especially face-to-face and on camera, the courage it takes is incredible. And I just want to say thank you to all those who will be coming forward in the future and who have come forward. And Simon was one of those at my first meeting who said that he would actually break the ice for everybody, because the meeting was essentially to introduce Amash to a group of experiences and a couple of researchers, including Dave Hodrian and Exopolitics people as well, to create this platform, to make this grow. And people were so scared. They were really frightened. One guy said to me, "Look, Joanne, I'm a dad. I coach football, for goodness sake, at the weekends with kids. I can't do that. I've already had business difficulties. My wife already is having problems with this." And you know what? At the end, after Simon had really helped people break the ice by coming forward and by being up front, that guy and several others came on camera for me. And I have to say, that was a fantastic thing to do, and that really was the birthing of Amash in the public arena. And since that time, after 15 months, we got a tremendous amount of interest from the media, which culminated with a Channel 4 documentary which they called Confessions of an Alien Abductee, which was absolutely appalling. And one of the reasons I wanted to have Simon on as a guest was also that he took part in that. And Channel 4 would not allow Simon to talk about anything to do with military. And let me tell you folks about this as well. The governments know, and military are involved, categorically. And we'll hear more evidence of that as these sessions unfold from people. So that's just, as far as I'm concerned, a given. And as I say, I'll expand on that as time goes on. So Amash was born to really develop this platform. And when the media thing came along, I really thought that the production company, who are lovely people and were very empathetic, would take us forward. But because their distributor and partner became Channel 4, that of course was never going to happen. So the integrity went out of the window. But nevertheless, let me tell you this as well, although I was really upset by what Channel 4 put out, I have to say I had 300 emails within about a month of people saying, "Well, I guess that's not how you wanted that to go." Yes, that was true. And also people saying, "Thank you. Thank you for being the one to put your head above the parapet, for taking the blows, for taking the flak, because I don't feel so alone anymore." And I can't tell you that that has been a recurring theme for people, the isolation from their communities, the isolation in as much as they have to live a secret life. And this secret life happens to them at all kinds of, times of the day, times of the night, quite frequently at night. And people come back with marks on their body. They come back with other aspects to their physicality, which down the line begin to play out as health issues, because part of my background has also been as a researcher in all things alternative, especially medicine and health and wellness. And I'm a therapist. My training was I spent 2 years with a lady who worked very shamanistic. But it's essentially a regression process which allows you to tune in to patterns that no longer help or serve, and invariably that goes into regression, whether it's ET or not. So I bring that to bear as well. And I've also done counseling with people going through bereavement and done a lot of support work and hosted and run workshops on healing and wellness. So I'm very passionately interested in what happens to these people down the line. Why is it that they are experiencing a lot of health issues? There are some very positive things that come through for people as well. Heightened abilities, heightened attributes, and such things as those that, let me give you an example, would be sometimes as precognition, which is very interesting. One of the people I've been working with for the last 2 years in a very concentrated way is a guy called Mike Smith, who you'll be hearing, if not next week, then soon. And Mike Smith is an ex-soldier, and he is also a musician, professional musician. He's a lead guitarist. And this guy has had some incredible things happen to him. And this is very interesting because he, a little bit like my second guest, didn't believe in anything to do with this subject, just thought it was a load of nonsense, and that basically people were either delusional, had too much to drink, or, you know, needed to see a psychiatrist. And then when he was 43, he had what he terms a download, and it really is like a download. It's almost like a near-death experience, in effect, in that he saw all his life play out, right up until the age he was 43, and included in all his life experiences were the very many abductions and also one contact when he was 10 that he experienced in this almost like a near-death experience. It's very classic near-death experience kind of scenario, except he wasn't in a near-death experience situation. So he has also now, he's going through a lot of health issues and problems. And I notice that a lot of people do, and they can be autoimmune scenarios. There's a lot of arthritis. Ladies can have a lot of adhesive tissue problems in the womb area, all kinds of things. We're going to have Hilary Porter on, I hope, next week. She's a lifelong experiencer, and she's going to be talking a lot about what she's been through, what it's like for the men and women, and what really is experienced by them. So Amash has a big remit, and it's getting larger and larger. Interestingly enough, we've had three conferences, two in Nottingham and one in Hastings on May 31st, 2014 this year. And very interesting, we drew the attention of the Wall Street Journal. Initially, I thought this was a hoax. And the Wall Street journalist, a guy called Matthew Dalton, who spent, I'm laughing because, again, it was a bit of a Channel 4 thing. I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to give this guy the time of day. I'm going to, you know, go out on a limb and give him an interview and see where he goes with it and really give him an opportunity with all the information he could possibly need, with access to people who were high quality, high caliber individuals, extremely articulate. So he could have every opportunity to write a fantastic article. And, of course, that didn't happen. It did go out. The Wall Street Journal article did appear in the U.S. edition, interestingly enough. But he came all the way over from Belgium, although he generally works on the economy side of things. So I thought that was quite an interesting thing. But nevertheless, it seems to be this kind of feeding out into the community. Because whilst Amash is a U.K. resource, I get a tremendous amount of contact from all over the world, from Israel, Venezuela, Buenos Aires, you name it, absolutely all over the world, including America, Canada, Australia as well. And I think it is that the one-on-one personal contact, the unjudgmental attitude, and just giving people a safe place in which to speak and giving them confidence again to feel okay about having these experiences has been a huge, huge thing that people have picked up. And so this seems to have gone around the world. And I couldn't tell you exactly how many people have been through the Amash doorway, phone way, or whatever. But I said, last year it must have been at least 1,500, but I think probably it's a lot more now, and I haven't, to be honest, counted them all. But I want to get on to Simon in the very next few minutes, because he has some amazing history, and then we're going to spend the second half of the show with Ray Hernandez of a new organization called FREE, which stands for Foundation for Encounters with... Foundation for Research of extraterrestrial encounters, and he'll be telling us some of the people that are involved with that. But for the moment, we're going to pick up a bit of music. We're going to play a David Bowie, Space Oddity, very appropriate, and I'll be seeing you after that with Simon. Well, thank you, Mr. Bowie. So I mentioned Simon, I'm bringing on now, and I have to say, Simon's interviews that we did, I think we did them, was it 2011, Simon?
Hello, Joanne, it was, nice to talk to you. It's a long time no see.
It brought a lot of interesting comment, doesn't it? I'm going to let you say, Simon's from Whitby, he's a part-time driving instructor, and he is a lifelong experiencer with memories from in the cradle, which is absolutely fascinating. He is also, interestingly, folks, an elected Labour councillor up in Whitby. So, Simon, can you give us a little bit of background? Your grandparents, your grandfather was particularly interesting, and then right through to your mum, and let's pick it up after then, about your experiences.
Okay, Joanne. But first of all, it is nice to be on your first show. And
yes, thank you very much.
Vin's doing a great job there. Seems quite a long time ago since we were in that Freemason Hall. I think it was was it Nottingham we were in?
Yes, indeed.
Yes, yeah. Well, my grandfather was a British diplomat. He was a British consul. He was a member of what became MI6. He was a prominent Freemason. And during his time with the diplomatic corps, he received the OBE medal, the MBE medal, the CBE, and he was offered a knighthood, but he turned that down. And after he retired, he was Britain's appointment to the United Nations. So my grandfather took up a seat in the UN, and his role was to keep an eye on the cotton industry. Now, back in the 1960s, the 50s and 60s, the cotton industry was very, very important, money spinner for what was then Great Britain. So my grandfather was quite an illustrious gentleman. He had two children, one the daughter, who became my mother. In about 1965, 66, it's very difficult to be sure, but around that time, she signed the Official Secrets Act and joined MI5, and her job was to type up documents that related to crashed alien spacecraft, which had come down all over the globe. These documents were in German. So from about 1965, 1966 to her death in 1979, that's what she did. So I didn't come from a military background family, but I came from what you would call loosely sort of a spying family.
It was very interesting too, wasn't it, Simon, because she had someone who was assigned to, well, perhaps assigned is not the correct word, but who came and briefed her on these documents, essentially, which she found very difficult to, working on the documents, very difficult to bear after a period of time.
Yeah. Anybody who works for the BSS, which is the British Security Service, better known as MI5, or the SIS, the Secret Intelligence Services, better known as MI6, will always have a handler. And my mother had a guy who would, who was a very gifted linguist. I think he spoke something like 7, 8, 9, 10 languages. And he would turn up at the flat. Excuse me, turn up at the flat, and he'd have his documents in German. And what he would have done was translate them into English on a spool of tape. We are talking now before the days when households had computers. So it was all done on a ferrous tape. And the document itself would go with the tape, and he would draw a penknife from his pocket, cut the ribbon that kept the document together, and then he had to sign it. And then my mother had to sign it, and that meant the document was in her charge, so he had no more responsibility for it. And these documents probably weren't very big, probably between 7 pages and 21 pages, and she would work flat out on them. Maybe within a week she would turn them round. And this guy would turn up, not to collect the documents, there was a different method for that, but he would always turn up with the documents, and he would talk to her about any issues regarding the documents. These documents never said what brought the spacecraft down, didn't explain why they'd crashed, nor did it say where they'd crashed. The documents just basically said, they all followed the same pattern, which is, this is what we have, this is what we think this piece of machinery does. This is how we think we can make it work. And then there would be a military brief, which would be, okay, you've got that. How can you apply this in a modern military age? And they would attempt then to get this group of scientists to make a practical application of a piece of equipment. And the scientists would have to come back and say whether they could or they couldn't. And that's what this document was.
How did you get to see the documents? How old would you be when this was going on?
It's a good question, isn't it? Because many people think, well, what's going on here? You know, this is supposed to be secret work. I would have been around about, I suppose, 7 or 8 years old when it kicked off. On Monday to Friday, I went to school, so I wouldn't see anything. But on Saturday and Sunday, my mother worked at home. And every lunchtime she would just go into the kitchen to make some food. And I would just go up to the typewriter, the desk, and couldn't read the document because it was in German, but could play the tape. Because, you know, it was the guy who would handle the business, he would speak one sentence in German, and then he would speak a sentence in English. So what my mother was doing was playing the English sentence and typing that out. So if I couldn't see the typed document that she was doing into English, then I would listen to the tape. So over a period of maybe 5 to 6 years, if I wasn't out on the weekend playing with my friends or at the cinema, then I would get maybe an hour or 2 hours every Saturday or Sunday reading these documents.
Oh, so they wouldn't try and keep it from you?
No, there was no effort to do that. And when I've spoken to researchers since then, they've often said, well, this is odd, because I would explain that this guy who would turn up would have these conversations in front of my mother with me there. The only time that I was told to leave was when my mother signed the Official Secrets Act, and I later found out that the law says that nobody else is supposed to be present when the Official Secrets Act is signed, only the person concerned and the person with the document. But other than that, they would have all these conversations about aliens and spacecraft and technology, and I would just be, as a small boy, I'd be playing with my train set or other toys, and they would just carry on the conversation when I was there. And at the time it didn't seem odd at all, but now, of course, looking back on it, it's incredibly odd.
Yes, and what impact did having to do this work have on your mother?
In the early days, not much, because I think she... I don't know, it's like the novelty of it or the thrill of it, but as it went on, she began to question what her role was. So she would say things like, you know, the government's lying, and, you know, she didn't feel too happy about that. And the response she got back was, well, you're part of it now anyway, i.e. you're perpetrating the lie, so you're as bad as us. And she didn't like that. And on one time, I remember, she said, well, you know, why am I doing this job? There are, must be lots of people in London who could do this job, because at the time we were living in a place called Brighton on the south coast. And the reply she got back was, well, you're the only person in this country that can do it, which made her sort of sit down, and physically, literally, she sort of collapsed onto the sofa, because she suddenly realised there was no getting out of this. They told her that she was the only one they had on the list. And then towards 1979, she became an alcoholic. She really couldn't cope with it. She didn't have any friends. She couldn't even talk to close people about what she was doing. They had threatened her when they made her sign the Official Secrets Act. They said to her that if she ever spoke about what happened or any of the work she did, then she would be found on a railway line. And then the guy who spoke to her said, well, you know, in that case, who's going to look after your son? So they made it very clear that they would terminate her if she didn't follow rules. So by 1979, she was quite heavily into alcohol, and she went to her handlers and said, I've had enough of this. I can't sleep. I can't do anything. My life's just gone to pieces. And they did promise her that they would give her her old job back.
Yes, I think you're saying that, yeah.
Yeah, so they did. They released her from the contract, for want of a better word, and she went back to her old job And amazingly, they just kept the job open for her. From about 1965 to 1979, she just walked straight back in again. And within 2 weeks, she was dead. So that problem was got rid of, wasn't it?
Yeah, indeed. But tell us something of your early memories, Simon, especially from the crib, because a lot of people won't have heard perhaps an experience ever before. And to have this memory, I think, is absolutely amazing, because a lot of people have it from childhood, but, you know, young childhood as opposed to babyhood. So tell us a little bit about what you remember about your encounters as a baby.
Okay. Well, I've been very lucky that I have a very, very good memory. Not for anything useful, like, degree subjects, but stuff that's not always so seen as so useful, I have a very clear memory of. And I have very good memories from a very young age, which most people just don't have. So the one that you're referring to, I think, is probably as a six-month-old baby, being in a cot. And I can remember the wooden bars, brightly coloured. And from the right-hand side, two very strange legs coming, walking towards me. Very strange. Although I was very young, I could tell that wasn't quite, you know, my mother's legs. And then these strange hands coming into the cot to lift me up. And at the time, all I could remember was, well, that's not familiar to me. Those hands, I'm not used to that. Grabbed me by my middle, I would say very firmly, but not hurting. And then I was lifted up, and then face to face with something that I'd never seen before. Basically, it was what researchers refer to as a mantid. The Americans call it a mantis. And looking into its eyes, I was, again, all I can describe is a telepathic communication, because the mouth didn't move. And yet I heard words in my head, and that's quite something when you first get into it. Of course, I'm quite used to it now. And then this great sensation of falling. So I always say to people, if you can imagine that you walked up to a well, a big well in the ground, and you turned and you fell backwards into it. Well, like you see some of these people who go off the high diving board into a swimming pool and they sort of dive backwards. So I got the impression of falling, and then just blanked out. So that was my very first experience
in this world. And talking about the mantis or the mantids, Simon, they really have a relation here to the praying mantis. The insect we know is a praying mantis, for those who aren't familiar with what we're talking about. Would you say that was...
No, I wouldn't. I say they have a general resemblance.
And yes.
I think what people do is they desperately look around for something that reminds them on this planet of something, and it gives them comfort to mention that. The main point I would say is that obviously I see a particular group or a particular branch of these creatures. That doesn't mean to say that that's all of them. Other people may see different types of them. And I can only speak for what I've seen. But the ones I've seen, if you think of an insect and the way that the legs sort of join to the thorax, well, the creatures that I interact with have very human hips, in the sense that the legs, there are two legs, and they actually come up just as ours do, to a hip-type bone. So they're not praying mantis in that sense of the word.
Right,
they're very, very normal like that. However, they are long, very tall and thin and stick-like, so I can clearly see how, you know, people can make that connection.
Yeah. So what was, as this experience went on, was this something that you experienced as a baby, or you remember as a baby happening regularly, being picked up and taken out of your cot?
No, the only cot experience I've got is that one. That's the only one that I can remember. Then we'd have to jump forward to probably being about 12 months old.
Okay. So let's have a look at those memories and see where they go. Sam, before we do that, can I just ask, I've got a remembrance of us speaking and talking about a download that happened around about 2010. And I don't know if that was a lot of information coming down or whether you'd had some of these memories already, you know, available to you.
Yeah, it's apparently when a person reaches sort of the around about the 50 bracket, whether you are emotionally capable of remembering stuff that you've hidden in the past, or whether there's just like a, for want of a better word, a clock that these memories have, and the clock ticks off and lets you have them. So I would say that I've always had about 25% of the memories that I have now, which have been with me since childhood. But I would say that I've got 75% new memories. But often, over that period, which is about a year from my 50th birthday, these weren't just new memories. These were fill-ins for memories I'd already had. If I had a memory, say, from age of six, and I thought, oh, well, that's complete, I suddenly realised that it wasn't. I only had a partial memory because I was then remembering other elements to this. The best way to describe it would be you go to a cinema, and you can imagine that a film is a big reel of a film, and if you were to cut each individual slide or picture and mix them all up, but only take 100 of those and play those 100, you'd know what the genre of the film was. So it might be a cowboy film or a western film. You might spot one of the two of the key actors, but there wouldn't be enough of the film to show you what the plot was. So I think that's a very good way of describing it, that you can identify some of these characters, you can identify what's going on, but you don't know what the purpose is. So I'm very fortunate. I've had an awful lot of memories back, and I now know in my case what the purpose was. But for most people, it's something they're always seeking to understand.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you had the sort of 75% comeback, Simon, what was your understanding of what the purpose was, what this means for you as an individual here on this planet, and maybe, I don't know, maybe as a multidimensional being, and that may be a stretch for some people, but we can talk about that as well.
It will be a stretch for some people, but it's a place they need to go to. If they're serious about understanding what's happening on their planet, then that's something that might well worth pay them to do a bit of research. For me, I've always been very fortunate that I'm a very, very calm, quite a solid person that doesn't get upset or agitated. And I guess that's probably one of the reasons these things come to me, because I don't overreact. So over a period of time, and it would be months, I began to put together a picture as to why I was being interacted with, and what the purpose was. And it was incredibly complex. It wasn't straightforward, it wasn't simple, and I didn't actually have too much of a problem to accept it, because when I look back on my life in what I would call the 3D world, which is this physical world, and the 4D world, I could find that there were similarities and that it was all leading down one particular route. So I had a lot of sort of helping hands, shall I say, to push me towards this goal.
Okay, and can we know what that goal is at the moment, or is that still developing?
No, I think that to answer that question, you'd have to pose another question, which is, why do these creatures involve themselves with certain people on Earth? In other words, not everybody is being interacted with. What is it about these people? And it generally revolves around two points. One is bloodline, and the second one is your soul. So if you come from a family that can trace a bloodline, genetic connections right back in history, then that is of interest to them. And then, if it's not too much of a jump for your listeners, if we believe in reincarnation and your soul coming back, then it's your soul and what history that's got. So, and I've always made this analogy, that if you think of a vet who tranquilizes a fox and puts a radio bleeper on it, and then that fox has cubs, and then the vet goes and puts bleepers on those, and over a period of 20 years, they follow family after family of foxes, and they build up a big picture of them. Well, in some ways, that's exactly what's happening to some people on the planet here. They are being followed, but not just through 10 or 20 years, but through thousands of years. So a particular individual's family, traced right back through history, will always have been interacted with.
Yes, it's such a common trait, that this intergenerational factor. It is really a marked aspect of the abduction scenario or contactee scenario. And what have you brought from that into your life? How has it developed you, Simon? Because this is an area of interest as well.
Well, it's taught me who I am. It's taught me the difference between my physical organism, which is my physical body, which is not important at all, and the spirit that resides within me. You can call that a soul. Yeah. That is really me, and the history of that. And coming to terms with the great power that humankind has, but hasn't realised it yet, how wonderful humanity can be. A whole range of stuff that you couldn't grasp it all in one day, and it takes a good few years to get your head around it. I think I had the fast track course, though, to be honest with you.
Yeah, interesting, Simon. I think that as I said before, there's been a lot of response to the initial interviews we did though back in the day, and I think from that set a bit of a ball rolling, putting you on the radar in quite a big way, because also there were factions who didn't want you to continue to be open, because you're incredibly open about what you're doing, about your experiences, and have been re-elected since we did that video. And so people elected you knowing that that material was out there, which I think says a lot for the people of Whitby. That's fantastic. Absolutely great. But also, I'd quite like to just touch base with the incident that happened on the motorway, because just for the listeners, just to flag up that often when people such as Simon and others who come forward and state their case and talk very openly about where these lines go and what it means for us all and for them, and the lineage, there are factions of humanity and perhaps some others of planeters who don't want this information out because it upsets what they want to do. And they do make some quite determined efforts to discourage any further exploration in the public domain. And Simon was certainly had that experience quite dramatically on a motorway. So Simon, tell us about what happened with your RTA?
That's a road traffic accident for anybody who doesn't know. It actually was on the A64, so it was a dual carriageway. It wasn't quite a motorway, but it was the A64. I had been approached by a young woman who now works for the Rothschilds, and she had been tortured as a young child, in order to make her more compliant so that she would take instructions as she got older. It's quite a common thing with elite families. But they'd done an awful lot of damage to her emotionally. And there was probably not many people on the planet who could put her right. So she wasn't living in this country. She was sent to me to put right. Her father was a governor of a city. He was an owner of a football club. He was a millionaire. Worked for the Rothschilds himself. And part of the deal was that this woman had to be relinquished a satanic cabal, probably part of the elite Freemasonry group, who had hold of her, had to release her to my charge so that I could put her right. And the instruction came down from on high that she had to be released, but there was a small faction operating without orders in a particular Freemasonry lodge who didn't like the fact that, you know, they were going to lose control of this individual. So driving this individual back to Heathrow Airport to get her back on her airplane, we were rammed on the left-hand side, so that's a car undertaking us, at 60 miles an hour. my poor old car was completely smashed to pieces. It was a complete write-off. And amazingly, we weren't really hurt very much. The other car that rammed into us only had one wheel left. My car, we were trapped in it because it was so smashed up you couldn't get the doors open. But we were very fortunate because there was an off-duty doctor, an off-duty nurse, and off-duty soldiers who were just there. And they got the door open and got us out, and the ambulance came. And the guy, was just quite odd. The guy who was driving the car that crashed into us, he seemed quite strange. He wasn't on drugs, he wasn't on dream. And I suppose the funny part of this is that the car that crashed into us was a company car, and its logo was ICU. And if you Google ICU, you get ICU Incorporated, which is a company that specialises on following people, sweeping for electronic bugs, doing traces on people, and prides itself that it has the numbers of the CIA, who are ex-members of the CIA who work for them. And this was the vehicle that crashed into us. So I find that rather amusing.
Absolutely interesting.
Yeah, I think so.
Because local newspapers also get involved?
Not on that one.
Prevent. Oh, okay.
No, that was my birthday car. That was not the car crash.
Oh yes. Oh yeah. But that was. I mean, that is really. I don't know whether you want to talk about that one, Simon. That is just mind-boggling.
I don't talk about anything. It's about time, isn't it? It's about how much time you've got, Joanne.
Yeah. Well, we've got about 6 or 7 minutes to go. I don't know whether you want to flag that one up, but we can speak another time on that particular issue, Simon, because I am interested also to know. Perhaps we'll save that one for later. But so there we go. So, and Simon, it's not the first time that you've had incidents, but perhaps not quite so dramatic, but people haven't been able to derail you.
No, there are forces at work which are higher than anything that humanity can throw. So for every, you think of a balance of scales, for every counterbalance there's another balance, and the scales tip one way or the other, and for a little while one side's in an ascendancy and then it swings back again. No, I'm not ever going to die like that.
No, good. I'm very glad to hear it. Now, Simon, I'd be interested to know how you feel sort of in the intervening sort of 3 years. Do you feel that just flagging up a MASH that was instrumental in being a support to you, to helping you get, your story out there? Because you've also written a book about your story, which I hope we're going to see out in the not too distant future. But I'm quite interested to know what you feel as now a seasoned speaker about your...
Okay, well, yes. Amash gave me the opportunity to get my story out. And the reason that I went public, Joanne, was simply because it was a story too big to sit on. I know, you think, well, I think other people need to know this and they can then go and do their own research. But it was the same thing that drove my mother. People were lying to the ordinary people, the governments, the military, they all knew the truth, but they didn't think that the ordinary people had the brain power to cope with it. So they were making judgments about people, and I guess I was sort of trying to do the same thing, which was, look, I'll give you my story, and for those of you who are interested, go and do some research, and you decide. At least then you've had something to balance all the nonsense that you get from the established media. In terms of Amash, yes, it did. It was a platform for me. But I did notice that after a while I began to get attacked because, I was fairly regularly appearing on Amash and doing stuff. And so in the end I thought, right, well, it's not fair really on Amash. I can cope with this, but it's not really fair on Amash or anybody else. And if I was to move away, then the attacks hopefully would die down from Amash's point of view. So, yeah, Amash was instrumental in allowing me to come forward, because in your intro you said there was nothing really in Britain, and you're quite right, because I first had to join America, MUFON, which is the mutual UFO network. because there was absolutely nothing in Britain at the time. So, and I was with MUFON for, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 months. And then, of course, you guys came along, so I joined you.
Well, Amash certainly has had a baptism of fire, I must say. But it's very interesting, Simon. Like everybody, it's an entity unto itself almost, and it is growing and developing spiritually as well as soulfully. And I think that we're on a really exciting trajectory at the moment. And I'd really like to invite you back, Simon, but we're coming up to a song shortly. But I'd just like to give you a few minutes to just say where you think your experiences have taken you as a human being and what it is that's the most important thing about them that you've learned and that you think we should know about.
You see, you always ask the good questions, Joanne. Generally when I'm interviewed, I'm interviewed by people who are very well-meaning but don't have the knowledge. So I get asked the very physical, materialistic, technological type questions. You sort of ask much more spiritual questions. We are talking about a spiritual development here. We're talking about a deep understanding of who I am, what humanity was and is and can be. In terms of myself, I learned why I'm here, what my role is, and how I need to go about and do that. And also some of the gifts that I was given as an individual, how to develop those, to become more psychic, to be able to play a more useful part for the role of humanity. So I think everyone has a role to play, but many people don't actually understand what their role is. I think I'm very privileged and very lucky to have some grasp of why I'm here and what I'm about. So we haven't got the time at this stage to really talk about that in detail, but I feel very privileged and very honoured to have witnessed what I've witnessed and to know the truth, and I just want to share that with everybody.
And I think it's also amazing, Simon, that you were re-elected again by the people of your area.
Well, I went public. I went public with you and other radio stations and newspapers, and I determined to do it that way. And then I stood for election because, I didn't want the charge that, oh, well, you just got elected and then you've done it. I wanted people to know all about me and have the choice. So, yes, I was elected and people knew. And frankly, it wasn't an issue to them. They didn't really care. And what they wanted was somebody who would help them. And interestingly enough, what they said was, you're not frightened. You go on television or, you go on radio. So we know that you'll fight our corner. You won't be scared off or chased away. And I think 20 years ago, that wouldn't have happened. I think that humanity is changing and it's becoming more aware.
Yes, and it's interesting, Simon, as well, just to round up there, that a lot of people, there's a lot of young people, and I'm hearing from mums and dads from time to time about their babies and their children being interacted with, but also people in their 40s and 50s. That's a really big area opening up of people coming forward, and I even had a lady who was 85 who contacted me some months ago. And I'm just going to throw this out there. This is going to throw the feather in the fire. And she rang me to tell me that her sons didn't know this, but she'd been an abductee, contactee for many, many years. And even 5 years prior, so when she was 80, a reptilian had burst in on her in her room and tried to grab her and said, "You are mine." And she calmly, quietly told him, because she was a religious lady, well, I'm not actually, I belong to Jesus. And with that, this being kind of lost its grip, lost its power, and desisted and disappeared. And that's a whole other story we get into about how we can interact when we're being interacted with in a fashion that is challenging for us. But that lady was 80 when that happened and 85 when she phoned me. And I just think that's an amazing testament that she even came forward. So There's amazing stuff in all ages, all ranges of life, all walks of life that this is happening to, folks. So please don't think it is restricted to any kind of person, any kind of race. It is not. Right, we're going to have a little bit of respect for this subject, and Aretha Franklin is going to sing to us all about that. And I'll be coming back with Ray Hernandez, and I want to say, Simon Parks, thank you very much. You've been fantastic, and please come back and talk to us another time. And if you'd like to stay and listen, and maybe feed in, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the Amash Files, and I'm absolutely delighted to have all the way from Miami, Florida, Reyniero Hernandez. I just had to say your full name, Ray. I'm sorry. I just had to practice that again.
Excellent pronunciation.
Thanks, Ray, for being with us. And I wanted to bring you on, and I'm really, really delighted because this field has not had a body since John Mack, and I know John Mack was one person, but Dr. John E. Mack, who is a psychiatrist, professor of psychiatry at Harvard, dealing seriously with this subject. And you, Ray, have had a most extraordinary experience because I do know that you are an estate tax attorney with the IRS in Miami and that you've been doing that for about 14 years and that up until about 2.5 years ago, you also didn't really give much credence to any of this field, the UFO, the contactee, the experiencer. So perhaps we can talk about what changed that, Ray.
So correct. 2 years ago, my whole worldview came crashing down. Prior to that, I had been pretty much in the academic field. I had been a researcher. I have graduate degrees from Harvard. Excuse me, from Cornell University, which is an Ivy League school, and from the University of California at Berkeley, which is a very prestigious university here in the United States, at Berkeley. And I worked as a researcher and a university professor for several years at different universities, namely the New School for Social Research in Manhattan and also the City University of New York. also in Manhattan, and also I taught graduate classes at UC Berkeley as well. And for the last 15 years, I've been working as a state's attorney with the Internal Revenue Service in Miami, Florida. And about
Ray, before we get into your experience, yes. Sorry to yes. just Vin, I'm hearing quite a bit of disturbance on Ray's call. Is it coming through clear to you?
It's coming clear here, but it's just breaking fine. Up a little every now and again. But we can hear it fine.
Okay, that's great. Ray, sorry about that. I didn't know whether that was getting disturbed over the airwaves. So please continue. So Ray, did you catch me there? So if we continue with your with your story.
Yes, thank you. Approximately in March of 2012, both my wife and I encountered an energy being inside our own living room. The dimensions were approximately 2 feet in width by 3 feet in height. She saw it a little bit differently than I did, but being aboard our Russell Terrier, who had been paralyzed the night before. And it was a miraculous cure. We were going to put her to sleep that morning. And it controlled my mind. It told me what to do, told me when to wake up. So after that date, I basically went berserk, going on the internet, reading books about UFOs, aliens, ETs, things that I had never even thought about in my life. Yeah. And that's how it initially started.
And the wonderful thing is about this story of this energy being appearing in your living room was the fact that your wonderful dog of 16 years who had, you know, through old age had a stroke and gone into paralysis, because I'm such an animal person, my goodness. I loved this story. And then when I asked you, gosh, did she live for much longer, just the next day or something after this energy light being had healed her? And you said, oh no, 9 months. So that was fantastic. So, but doesn't it go to show you the power of what these others have and the abilities they have if we can learn to communicate and collaborate? And that's where FREE comes in, which is the Foundation for Research for Extraterrestrial Encounters.
Yes, I am a co-founder together with Mary Rodwell from Australia and Christina Knowles from Boston, of a non-for-profit organization titled FREE, the Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters. And our website is experiencer.co, not com, but co. So it's experiencer.co. And our website got launched on September 1st. And I encourage everyone to go check it out.
But it's an excellent one as well. Sorry, Ray.
Yes, to answer that question, pretty much our dog, before she had the stroke, which she had the night before, she had it on Saturday at approximately 6:30, and then this energy being appeared the very next day, Sunday morning at 6 a.m. So it was approximately 12 hours later that this being appeared. And before then, our dog was very, very lethargic, moving very, very slowly. We just hated to put her to sleep because she was like our child, our first child. And so after she was cured, she had the energy of a puppy. She was running around at blazing speed, jumping up and down like she was a little puppy. And my wife was screaming and hollering through the whole living room, "Hallelujah, hallelujah, the angels cured her, the angels cured her." So, and in my head, I was like, what the hell just happened, you know? But after that, my wife began to see very large crafts, pretty much on a monthly basis. And these were huge crafts. One time, a craft that she saw, she described it as very angelic, that had colors like the crystal, windows in our church, you know, very full. Yes. And my next adventure occurred approximately 6 months later, which was in August of 2012. I got this crazy idea to call down a craft. And I believe that these ETs told me, you know, that, look, we're coming down and make believe like you're calling us, you know. But basically what had happened was I was at night outside a totally cloudy sky. A friend of mine was going to be coming by to give me some documents. And I said, okay, I'll wait for you outside. And then what happened was I remembered the day before I saw a YouTube video of this individual that was calling down these crafts. So I said, the hell with it. Let me try to experiment. And so I said, oh, I want to see the beautiful craft that my wife saw 3 months earlier, the angelic craft with the colorful colors like a stained glass window. She had the privilege of seeing you. I didn't get to see you. Then I would turn around, do a 180 and look around, nothing, right? I did that for 15 minutes. After 15 minutes, I said to myself, I'm really, you know, losing it, you know. I really have gone over the edge this time, you know, doing some crazy shit like this, you know. All of a sudden, this huge, gigantic craft was the size of a football stadium, like Wembley Stadium, right, appeared right on top of our neighbor's house. The palm trees in our neighbor's house were blocking the bottom part of this craft. It was less than 20 meters away from us. I could have gotten a rock and hit it. And all of a sudden, a thought popped into my mind, and that was the voice of my daughter. And it was the voice of my daughter saying, Daddy, you and Mommy have seen a UFO. Next time you guys see one, I want to see one too. So you call me, all right, Daddy? Don't forget, don't forget. So I, without thinking, you know, my daughter just turned years old, rashly thinking, you're not going to get a 10-year-old involved in something like this, right? But, you know, my mind was controlled, and I'll go into more details of that later on. I took about 10 feet to the right, and I started yelling at my daughter because I live in a cul-de-sac. And I said to my daughter, Scarlett, Scarlett, Scarlett. And so she opened up the window. What is it, Daddy? What is it? There's a UFO out here. There's a UFO out here. Get out here. So she runs outside, and she's outside like in, you know, 10 seconds. So now you have two people looking at this huge craft. And my daughter asked me, Daddy, what is that? And I said, it's a UFO, and it's in hiding because it doesn't want to fully show itself. And what it was thousands and thousands and thousands of oblong light streaks that formed the whole internal and external shell of the craft. But yet it was transparent. It was see-through. It was a totally cloudy sky, so you could see the clouds in the sky in the background. You couldn't see any stars. Then about 15 minutes later, we were watching this show. Basically, it was like a light show. We weren't scared. We were being entertained. All of a sudden comes my friend with his wife and their 17-year-old daughter. Now, you have to think, remember that both of our friends were hardcore Catholics. Both of these guys are, one is from Mexico, the other one is from Colombia. The type of Catholic that will do the rosary bead prayer for 10 hours nonstop, you know? You know, go to the bathroom for 10 seconds and come back and continue with the rosary beads. That type of hardcore Catholic. So then both of them were freaking out. They were like, what is that? What is that? And I said, you know damn well what it is. They said, no, it can't be. It can't be. You know, it's got to be atmospheric conditions. I said, yeah. Have you ever seen atmospheric conditions like this? No, it's got to be light reflecting off of the traffic lights from the cars behind us in the street, like a block and a half away. Oh, yeah, sure. You know, it's just oblong, horizontal light streaks, thousands of them. So they were coming up with excuses and excuses. And then to my head, I said, they don't believe you, fellas. They don't believe you, you know. And all of a sudden, the light streaks changed. All of these oblong light streaks totally stopped and were replaced with thousands and thousands of stars, 10 times the size of Venus, blinking on and off in a fraction of a second, like 3 or 4 times on and off in a fraction of a second. And then I told them, now, do you believe these guys? You know, like laughing, you know? And so without a shadow of a doubt, everyone knew what it was. Now, here's the crazy stuff, right? After 10 minutes of this, of watching these stars, all of a sudden they say, okay, we got to go. We got things to do. And that's not the rational thing to do. You're watching a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and all of a sudden you got to go, you know? And I didn't even think about, you know, them leaving. Okay, see you later. Don't worry about that paper. I'll take care of it, you know. And then after 10 minutes, I felt like I was being attacked by mosquitoes. After about a minute of whacking my legs from these so-called mosquito bites, I grabbed my daughter, and this light show was still continuing with this huge Wembley Stadium UFO craft that I could almost spit on, okay? And my neck strained because I was just looking up the whole time at Wembley Stadium. And so I go I go inside. Then a couple of minutes later, my daughter goes to me, "Daddy, there were no mosquitoes outside." And all of a sudden, it's like I woke up from being in a hypnotic trance. And I said, "Holy shit, what the hell just happened?" And I grabbed my video camera, my regular camera. I ran outside. Poof, it was gone.
And so then, I went to film it.
Yeah, no. We were totally under control. And then the real crazy stuff happened afterwards. For 4 months straight, from pretty much of September, October, November, and immediately crazy. Now, what had happened to me with that light being inside the house? And all the time, I was just being confused. You know, they're devils, they're gods, they're Anunnakis, they're this or that. You know, so what happened was immediately after I had that light show at the Wembley Stadium outside of my house, I immediately went and read 12 hours a day books on near-death experiences and consciousness studies. And again, it was like someone that was on crack or heroin. It was that type of an infatuation. 12 hours a day, I would be reading books on these two topic areas. I would order 10 books from Amazon. When I had two left, I would order 10 more. When I had two left, 10 more. I became an expert on NDEs and consciousness studies. I had never spoken to anybody about NDEs for 4 months straight, only my wife. And my wife is an experiencer herself, but she thought that I had crossed over that ledge, you know, that I was now totally nuts. And then what happened was in late December, my daughter had a fever for 2 days straight. And my wife always brought her to our pediatrician, who I never met. I brought her to the pediatrician, then out of the blue, part of my brain, without control, was asking this doctor, had she ever heard of NDEs? "Excuse me, doctor, have you ever heard of NDEs? I've just finished reading approximately 300 books on this topic. Out of those 300 books, 75 were written by medical doctors. Out of those, approximately 20 to 25 were written by medical professors in medical schools. And it's something that's been scientifically validated, and you should know about this." All of a sudden, her eyeballs pop out. And I said to myself, "Holy, shoot! I offended, this woman, So I said, "Excuse me, doctor. I apologize. I don't know why I said that. It just came out of my mouth." She goes, "No, you didn't offend me. How do you know I had one?" And then she goes on and tells me the details of her NDE, where she basically described everything that went on in the operating room, the emergency room that she was being attended to. She then floated above her parents and told me a 15-minute conversation that her parents had, which was validated by her parents. Described the doctor, 6'3", blonde hair. The nurse, 5', 200 pounds, short, stocky, with a short haircut and a 1950s glasses. 15 minutes later, after she gets resuscitated and told her parents what went on, all of a sudden comes the doctor and the nurse coming to see how she is, exactly how she had described it. That was on a Friday.
Yeah.
That was on a Friday. The next day, on a Saturday, it was at a church dinner, and I'm not religious, I'm spiritual. But at that point, I was still an atheist. I went to church to accompany my wife with her activities, because she's hardcore Catholic. So I met this man, a total stranger, and again, out of my mouth comes the same statement verbatim. And as I was saying it, I was like, "Why in the hell am I saying this shit? I don't even know this guy, but yet it's coming out of my mouth." His eyeballs pop out. Then he tells me a story of an NDE of his mother that died in his arms. She even saw the paramedics, a huge black guy, 6'3", 300 pounds, football player type of guy, followed by a short white woman with a long blonde ponytail, dressed in a paramedics outfit. And when she got resuscitated 45 minutes later at the hospital, he said, "How do you know that? Those were the paramedics." Then she went described going into the tunnel, the light, seeing her deceased husband, talking to God, the full works, That was on a Saturday. The next day, on a Sunday, I said, I need to tell my atheist father what the hell just took place on, you know, yesterday and on Friday, right? So I go to his house, and I call my mother and my father, and I said, Mom and Dad, I need to tell you this, you know? So I tell him what took place Friday and Saturday. My father goes, yeah, that happened to me. I go, say what? Then he tells me 15 years before he had a near-death experience where he floated out of his body. He went to the tunnel and to the light. He had a life review that lasted at least 30 years. Okay. He told me, he says, up there, time doesn't exist. He said, God showed him all the good and the bad stuff that he had done in his life, not only from his brain, but from the brain of the person that he had impacted. Okay.
Yeah.
And then after that, driving home, I looked up in the sky and I had an epiphany, you know, basically it's like, holy shit, this stuff is real. You know, I can't keep denying it, you know? And then I looked up in the sky and I looked up at God and the ETs and I said, congratulations. In a 4-month period, you have managed to get an atheist, material rationalist, convert him into someone that believes in God, the afterlife, that we are spirit more than any Catholic priest in Miami. So I salute you, you know.
Yeah, they did a job.
A tremendous job. And since that date, almost every week, I have one huge experience after another. And I sent you a document providing some of those experiences. And I know that you were quite shocked by reading them.
Well, not so much shocked, Ray. It's just that so much happened in such a short space of time. I mean, you know, you've had about 2 or 3 lifetimes in about 2.5 years.
Yes.
Not only that, I believe that you put at their door the concept for starting free.
Well, actually, what happened was in May of 2013, I had just come back from my first and only ever UFO conference. And it was like 3 or 4 days later, I'm driving on a congested highway going into downtown Miami, 8:30 in the morning, middle of a traffic jam. All of a sudden, I got what I call an ET telegram. It was both a voice that popped into my head, and I saw a video that surrounded it. And that video was the same video that this lady, Audrey Hewins, who started this group called Starborn Support in the U.S., she said it was the exact video that she saw when she got one of her many downloads. The video basically said that I need to do an organization that's going to be presenting to the world the relationship between ETs, the spirit world, and quantum physics. And
yay.
Then the video that I saw was sort of like that video in the Price is Right wheel. You know, I think they have that show in the UK where, you know, you spin around and all these colors flash around. Oh, you want $200, you want 300, you know, pounds, whatever it is. But what it was in my case, it was inside these different color wheels were different paranormal topics, out of body experiences, remote viewing, meditation, mystical travel, the spirit world, ETs, telepathy, teleportation, you know, on and on and on, all these paranormal stuff. And you know, the spirit world, the multidimensional realities. And what was holding everything together was quantum physics. Now,
yes.
In my head, I was like saying to the ETs, man, you got the wrong guy because, you know, I was terrible in math. I was very good, you know, in writing. I could crank out a 50-page paper in one night and get an A on it, you know. I went to the most prestigious universities in the world, you know. But when it came to math and physics, forget it, you know. So you got the wrong buddy, you know. And then what happened was I immediately called Christina Knowles at 8:30 in the morning. She
and
was living
Christina,
in Boston.
Can I just say she's an experiencer, Ray?
Yes,
Christina.
Yes. And Christina's been an experiencer since she's been a child. She's been an ET researcher for the last 15 years, and she was the only person that I had been in communication with, and it was only for like the 3 months. And she was, you know, the only outlet. And as you know, when you're having these experiences, you're desperate to talk to somebody, you know?
Absolutely.
And Christina was my outlet. So I called her at 8:30 in the morning, and I said, you know, Christina, are you up? She says, yeah. I says, you won't freaking believe what the hell just happened. And I told her. And then And she said, you know, pull over if you need to, you know, if you're freaking out. I said, first of all, I can't pull over. I'm in the middle of a traffic jam. And secondly, I'm not freaking out. I'm just, you know, bewildered. You know, what the hell just happened, you know? And then what happened was that same night, okay, some of the listeners here out in the audiences in the UK might know Mary Rodwell, might have heard her speak or know about her. She sent me an email that very same day at night, in the evening. Dear Ray, I'm so sorry that I lost your email that you sent me 6 months ago, but all of a sudden it just popped up on my screen. and then she said, oh, my God, the experience that you and your daughter and your friends had seeing that huge, gigantic football stadium-sized craft. I've never heard of any story come close to that. And then I sent back an email. I said, Mary, you ain't heard nothing yet. This is what happened today, you know. And then after that, she responded back. She said, Ray, we need to talk on Skype. And so what happened was, and she told me about this fellow, Dr. Rudy Shields, that she knew when she went to give a presentation at the John Mack Institute. And as you know, John Mack was a professor at the Harvard Medical School. He's a full tenured professor of psychiatry. And so after he had passed away, Mary was asked to give a presentation to a conference that was being held in his honor. And that's where she met Dr. Rudy Shields, who was a professor at Harvard, a very dear friend of Dr. Mack, and he's a retired professor of astrophysics. So anyway, the next day at 9:30 in the morning, I got a call from Dr. Rudy Shields. I don't even know who the hell this guy was, you know? Hello, is this Ray? I says, yeah. I said, who's this? Oh, this is Rudy Shields. Who? You know? And so for the next 90 minutes, he was spoon-feeding me quantum physics and how quantum physics can explain all the paranormal, including, you know, the spirit world, telepathy, all the of ufology issues, the ET contacts, how the ETs operate, etc. And that he had been studying these topics since he had first met Dr. John Mack, who began to use him as a consultant. Like, Rudy, how can this thing happen? You know, is it possible? And so he was actually mentoring Dr. Mack on the physics of the ET UFO phenomena. So anyway, at the end of the conversation, Rudy tells me, Ray, you need to seriously consider forming an organization to let the world view, to let the world know about this relationship. And if you do, I will be your scientific advisor.
How wonderful. And I just must say that Mary, just for people who don't know Mary Rodwell, that her organization is called ACERN. It's the Australian Close Encounter Resource Network. And she's been working for about, I think, 18 years or so. I think she's had that going. She's a nurse, hypnotherapist, who was in the UK and emigrated out to Australia. So sorry, Ray, just to pick that up. Thanks very much.
No, Mary is a divine, loving soul, and I mean that wholeheartedly. Mary was, and Christina and Rudy are the pillars to free. Without them, this organization cannot move forward, and I send all my love and blessings to Mary. I love her very much. We've been in weekly conversations for the last, since May, since we had that conversation of 2013. So anyway, Rudy was the first one to just suggest that we form an organization. Then he gave me the telephone number of Dr. Edgar Mitchell. For those that don't know Dr. Edgar Mitchell, Dr. Edgar Mitchell was the sixth man on the moon. He has a PhD in physics, physical aeronautics from MIT. He also is the father of modern consciousness studies. And I first became aware of who he was because I read all those books on consciousness studies during that four-month period. And so Rudy said that Edgar was actually his mentor and that they're very, very close and that Edgar only lives 90 minutes away from me. And he gave me his telephone number and he told me to call Edgar up. And so after we hung up, I was scared, you know what, to call Edgar because he's sort of like a demigod to me, you know? He's the father of modern consciousness studies. He's a genius among geniuses. So anyway, 4 hours later, I worked up the courage to give Edgar a call. And I told him, you know, Rudy gave me his number. He says, I've been expecting your phone call. You know, and I'm like, holy, you know, and then he invited me to his house the next day. I went up to his house, and oh my God, we were there like for 3 or 4 hours. He would like went on and on with all the stories how he grew up in Roswell. When he went back to Roswell in 1971, he was a hero. That all these old folks that he knew personally, the children and the fathers that knew all his parents, told him what really happened at Roswell. He was a test pilot with Chuck Yeager. He talked about other astronauts that had seen UFOs. He just went on and on and on. Finally, at the end of it all, he said, "Ray, I agree with Rudy. You need to form an organization. I will there to be to back you up with Rudy. We will be your initial advisory board members. We will be your science consultants." So that same night, I emailed Christina and Mary, and I said, "Look, we need to Skype." So we Skyped that night, and then I said, "Look, this is what happened the last 2 days. It's crazy, you know what, you know." I said, "This is truly unbelievable." And I said, "We need to form an organization." And I said, "Why don't the three of us be the co-founders, and Rudy and Edgar will be the initial advisory board members?" And 2 days later, Mary came up with the name FREE, Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters. And right now, we have a who's who of names that are advisory board members. We have Whitley Strieber. We have Kathleen Martin, who's one of the top ufologists and ET researchers in the U.S., we have Dr. Leo Sprinkle, who is a retired professor of psychology, who is the first academic to study the ET contact phenomenon, starting in 1962.
He's great. On and on and on.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I won't go over the names, but it's, you know, Linda Moulton Howe. We've got a who's who of these type of caliber individuals involved with FREE. And we have 5 quantum physicists in our group. We have 3 medical doctors. We have 5 PhD psychologists. And then just regular folks like myself and other folks, you know, that are experiencers. And so that's how FREE got started.
And it's exciting, isn't it? Because the mandate of FREE is to bring to bear all this fantastic brain power into working and disseminating and then producing for the rest of us some material to help us make sense and understand what the heck this is all about.
Yeah, most definitely. Let me, should I transition now to talk a little bit about FREE?
Yes, please. That's great.
Okay. Three, let me again reiterate our website. It's Experiencer, experiencer.co. That's our website. It only got started a month ago, so bear with us. We're still growing. We're still building it. Let me go over the different components of FREE. One component of FREE is, let me just summarize the 3 aspects of it. It's research, education, and support. So let me go through each one, okay? Let me start with the educational component. With education, our philosophy at FREE is that the ET contact experience phenomenon is extremely complicated. If you look at the media, especially here in the U.S., most individuals associate the ET contact phenomenon with mainly abductions, okay? When in fact, abductions is merely a small sliver. It's a small percent of the individuals that have had contact with ETs. Now, the definition of ETs, we're defining it as non-human intelligent beings, which is not necessarily the ufology type of ETs. Because, for example, many individuals that have had NDEs, near-death experiences, they describe those experiences as more real than you and I in our conversation right now, okay? They have encountered non-human intelligent beings in their experiences. Who are we to say that those are not ETs?
Okay? No, that's right. I think that's quite common.
Okay. People that have done mystical meditation or out-of-body experiences, numerous individuals, remote viewing, okay? Numerous books on remote viewing, mystical meditation. So many of these individuals, by the thousands, have described that they have had encounters with non-human intelligent beings with those type of experiences. Who are we to say that those are not ETs because they don't fit the standard rubric of ufology type of encounters? Okay. Exactly. And this leads, and this leads me to the next step, is that we in our organization, okay, are view the ET contact phenomenon, as I said, is extremely complex. We view the whole paranormal range of experiences as being embedded, as being ingrained, as being associated, as being the same phenomenon as the UFO-related contact experiences, okay? It's all one multi-universe matrix of reality that we're all ingrained with, except that people have been piecemealing them separately for, you know, many, many, many years. What we're doing is we're integrating it, okay? The next component that differentiates us, okay, is that not only do we not just focus on abduction, because it's much more complicated than abduction, not only do we incorporate the paranormal, the full range of the paranormal phenomenon, and I don't like that term, but at least folks can understand what that term is, but that's not an appropriate term, because the paranormal actually is normal, okay? What we're also doing is incorporating science into this phenomenon, okay? We're incorporating two aspects. One is the physics of how this takes place. And particularly, we're focusing on the quantum hologram theory of physics. Secondly, a derivative of the quantum hologram theory of physics is consciousness, okay? And I'm not referring to the metaphysical type of consciousness. I'm talking about the pure physics science consciousness derived from advanced physics. Mm-hmm. And we have in our organization, as I said, five genius physicists. Okay, all of them are experts in consciousness studies, and they're experts in quantum physics. And I don't want to go into the qualifications of these individuals, but we've got people from Oxford, we've got people from Harvard, from MIT, and most of them are listed in our website. A couple of them don't, one of them does not want to be fully publicly known. But these are individuals, some of these individuals, like are individuals that at the age of 8, they were playing around with advanced calculus in their brains, okay? You know, at the age of 14, they were writing papers on the quantum hologram before they were even published by David Bohm, okay, who's associated with this theory. That's the type of caliber of individuals. All of these individuals are experiencers, okay? So now we're mixing science and physics and consciousness into all of this, and we're mixing it all together into a very tasteful gumbo soup, okay? So that is our free website. We're meaning to educate individuals in terms of the full complexity that it deserves. And go check it out. We've got numerous articles. We've got numerous videos. Many of these professors and these experiencers have written articles about all of these fundamental related topics.
If I have anyone to say, wants, this is fantastic, Ray. It really is.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So that's the educational component, which is basically our website. In terms of the support component, many individuals, okay, are traumatized by this, okay? Many are not, okay? But for the ones that are traumatized, okay, we have several components of free that would hopefully help to address them. We have something called an experiencer buddy, and that's basically someone to talk to. Okay, if you go into our website and if you want to be able to talk to a buddy, you will send us an email at free, which we will have on our website, which is our email is free, F-R-E-E, at experiencer.co. So it's free at experiencer.co. And so what we will do is we will hook you up with someone to chat, someone to talk to. And we have a list of many volunteers that will assist you, talk to you, chat with you, guide you. We also have approximately a 30-page list of individuals spread throughout not only the U.S., but throughout the U.K. and Australia. And we're trying to build it for the rest of Europe and Latin America and Asia. And Africa, we don't have, I don't think, anyone in Africa. But we would like to build it up. These are references of individuals that have worked with experiencers in the past. These would be certified mental health therapists. These would be regression therapists or support groups. And so if anyone wants to communicate with any of these individuals, you would just look up by state, by city, by country, and we would have this list, which is close now to 30 pages on our website, and it's under the category of support. We also have many articles on support that have been written by our PhD psychologists, okay? We also have a chapter by Mary Rodwell on support. Articles by Dr. Barbara Lamb, also a certified mental health therapist, on the topic of support. Also, we have on our website an experiencer forum, which is an opportunity for you to chat and interact with other experiencers from all over the world. So if you need someone to talk to, go to the experiencer forum. Register for it. You can put a pseudo name. You don't have to include your real name. And then begin chatting with others. Talk about your experiences. Share your experiences. So that is our support component, which is our second major component. Our last major component is research. And let me tell you a little bit about how that component got started. Myself, having an academic background, one of the first things that I did was to do an academic literature review of the ET contact phenomenon. And what I found out was that there was almost nothing that was written academically on this phenomenon. There were books by Dr. Sprinkle, who is a member of our advisory board now. There were articles by Dr. John Klimo, a 40-year professor of psychology who has written on this topic for 40 years. But again, on very limited basis, there were the books by Dr. John Mack, Kenneth Bullard, Dr. Kenneth Ring. I could count them on my two hands, the number of academics that I've written, mainly articles on these topics. It was very, very limited. So what I did is I came up with an initial research methodology of doing a research study on this. And what it would be the first ever comprehensive, long-term, academic, peer-reviewed study on the ET contact phenomenon. And it would be based both upon quantitative questionnaires and numerous qualitative and quantitative secondary questionnaires. I then approached Dr. John Klimo, who's the world's leading academic on the paranormal. He has chaired over 250 PhD dissertations. 75 have been on the paranormal. And I introduced myself, and then I said, John, this is a little bit about what we're doing at FREE, and I want you to be the chair of this research study. And he was so blown away, and he was like, oh, my God, Ray, I was born for this. Oh, my God. And I said, we've got this person on our committee. We got that person on our committee, that person. I was naming all these names. And he had spoken and had knew about these very famous names, you know, for many years. And so that's how our research project got started. And we have now on our website the initial quantitative research questionnaire, which is basically to identify factors, components, whether you have had an experience or not. We are now working on approximately 20 different secondary questionnaires, very complicated questionnaires, and we have identified possible interviewers to administer these questionnaires. So it's taking us approximately a year to do just the methodology for this research study. So it's going to be very, very comprehensive, academically driven, and it's finally we might be able to address some of these questions that people have had all these years.
Yeah, I think this is absolutely exciting. I can't tell you that's why. I can't remember how we hooked up initially, Ray, but I was so excited about it. And on this Friday coming, I'm going to be visited by a young lady from Denmark who is over in the UK for at least 3 months while she is doing groundwork research for her PhD, which is anthropologically based. But as actually, and I might put her in touch with you, Ray, as well, because it is her subtitle is the effects on society of alien abduction. And this is a PhD student. So I'm really excited by this. And she'll be interviewed as well. And I'd be delighted to put her in touch because she's particularly interested in perhaps what's going on in the UK at the moment, because the UK is been very quiet in many ways, but with AMASH, that's certainly helping to lift the lid. And on the scientist side, I must say, I had a contact with a scientist who had been pharmacy was his area of science, and he had got a soil sample. I think it was Kentucky, from an area in Kentucky, where it had been seen that a UFO had discharged some matter into the soil, and that he had obtained a sample and done a full analysis of it. And he told me about this analysis. I haven't seen the paper, but he was hoping to get this published in a journal. I think it was Astrobiology. And you know, absolutely fantastic. And I invited him to speak at my conference on May 31st this year. And I'm laughing because I was quite surprised by his response. We got on very well, but it was clear that he was one of those individuals who has yet to come out of the box to let those sides down and let a bit of fresh air in there, because he told me in no uncertain terms that he didn't want to, in quote, be contaminated by association with this subject. Because I have some superb people who I would love to feed into you, who are known, I call them the biolocation team, and their website is biolocation.com. And these guys are using forensic dowsing to determine, they actually started off with ancient archaeology and some amazing results there, but they have actually been detecting things, ET, to such a precise, detailed nth degree, it is mind-boggling. And they would be absolutely, they would add an incredible dimension to all that you're doing. And they will be on the show, I hope, a few times, also feeding in with their absolutely incredible work. But I had to say, the scientist who didn't want to be contaminated by association, I thought was a very interesting indictment of the mindset still,
let me address that, because that's one of our fundamental objectives of free. Okay, we had a conversation off the air earlier this afternoon. What we want to do is something called as out of the closet videos, and what these would be short 3 to 5 minute videos where individuals from all walks of life would briefly state their experiences. And all of our scientists are going to be doing this. And we have like another 20 other scientists that are either consultants or working with us in different capacities with free. So all of a sudden, you're going to be getting there, you know, 20 medical doctors. You're going to be getting research biologists, chemists, university professors, tons of physicists, on and on and on. Hello, my name is Joe Schmo. I've had contact with an ET, you know, I mean, on and on and on.
So, oh, I can't wait. That's going to be so interesting to see. I shall be sending them on to this gentleman. I shall definitely point them in that direction and see what he makes of.
So the idea really is to start a gay movement for experiencers, you know, coming out of the closet. You know, it might take us 20 years to be legislated, you know, to get the legislation that the gay movement got, you know, 20 or 30 years, you know, but at least, you know, you see, you know, gay relationships on TV and movies, and it's a non-issue now. It's a non-issue. But yet 40 years ago, people used to beat them up, you know?
Yeah.
That is one of the objectives that we want to have to Doing Free, to let people know that there are millions of experiencers, not thousands,
absolutely,
millions are out there, except everyone's hiding in a closet, you know?
That's a great visual. Well, yeah, I mean, and that's what Amash is about as well. It's lifting the lid. It's providing a platform and, you know, empathy to allow people to even have the confidence to come forward, because it really does take, you know, a lot of courage. And hopefully with your kind of organization, and hopefully Amash will be feeding into Free as well and sharing work.
Most definitely.
So exciting, Ray.
Yes, most definitely. You know, Free is basically a collaboration tool. All the different all the different people involved with our organization. They're still maintaining the organizations, like Mary with Acern, okay? But we're not really an umbrella that holds everyone glued together. No, everyone is separate and distinct. What it is, as you know, for so many years, people have been so disjointed. They've been working in their little fiefdoms, their little anthills, without communicating, without elaborating, with their little petty squabbles, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Man, isn't it about time we start communicating with each other? We start working with each other? You know, it's the same phenomenon. It's real. People by the millions are having these experiences. And we need to unite. We need to work together. And yet, you know, continue our own individuality of what we specialize in. But at least, you know, we need to share information, collaborate, because it's not being done separately to different countries or cultures or colors and races. No, it's the whole world, you know, as you know.
Well, I think it's fantastic that it's taken a tax attorney to get it together, Ray.
An ex-atheist material rationalist, you know.
I love it. I think the irony is wonderful. I get a lot of fun out of that. And I have to say, how wonderful that you're just, you're doing it. I mean, I know, you know, in our previous conversation, you did say, well, I feel like I'm a bit of a marionette. You know, they tell me to go left, I go left. They tell me to go right, I go right.
Sorry. If I could elaborate a little on that, and so just explain to people, I've had, you know, you read a little bit about my quote unquote stories, my experiences.
Sure. Yeah.
And it's just, you know, to anybody else out there, it's like that they would put me in an insane asylum, you know? but yet my stories, can be more clearly described, and I hate that you use synchronicities, because that's just such a BS word, because this is happening to me and so many others is just so much more profound than synchronicities. I don't communicate with these ETs, like, hello, you know, little blue, gray, you know, or my fellow Palladian being, you know, I don't have those type of communications. I don't see them. I don't hear them. I don't talk to them. But yet, it's difficult to explain. They put everything in front of me. Okay. Whenever things needed to be done, they would have channelers that would be channeling stories to me, you know, when messages needed to be conveyed. They would have person out of the blue, Ray, I just, you know, my ET told me to tell you this, you know, people that I just met like an hour ago or something like that. You know, it's just crazy stuff like that happening all the time. Then I go tell that message to the third person, and he goes, Ray, unbelievable, you know, because last night I was told the same thing, that you would be telling me this, and I just wanted to confirm and validate. It's just endless, these types of things that are happening to me. So what I personally think is that they don't physically appear to me or physically communicate with me, because who knows, I might be one of those types that will just, you know, in the middle of the night punch them out or something like that, you know, or take a bat, you know, so like, you know, this guy is Cuban, he grew up in New York, you know, he had a hard life, you know, he knows how to fight, defend himself, let's stay away from this guy, you know. So I don't know, but but it's like, it's been validated, all of my experiences from so many different people, you know, one after another, and And it allowed me to build free together with my dear friends and colleagues. Because this is not just me. This is Mary Rodwell, Christina Knowles, our co-founders. Then yes. We've got the help of Dr. Mitchell, Dr. Rudy Shields, Ralph Steiner, who's been sort of like my mentor. He's one of these genius physicists, and so many other people that have been working with us at Free. I can't name so many, but they've become integral factors of what we're doing.
Yeah, I know also that, for me, this whole arena is a 360 thing. And what I mean by that is it takes in every single facet of the human condition, including energy, including health, including everything. And I know that, you know, when we look at, for example, the energy issue and free energy technology, that, you know, that is something that we're going to learn down the line that is going to change. And I'm really looking forward to that because it absolutely has to come. But I'm just going to ask you to just...
Can I briefly address that last point? I think that's
sure,
very important.
Of course.
I know that free energy is right down the pike. Okay.
Yeah.
I know it for a fact. Okay. However, the human race is not ready for it. We are barbarians. If we had that technology where it stands right now, we would blow each other to smithereens. So humanity has to go through a profound spiritual transformation. It might take, you know, 100 years, 200 years, whatever it might be. Okay. But right now, when where you're having such hatred, such animosity towards each other as humans, I really fear that if this technology gets released, that we might destroy 98% of humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's a very valid point. But in any event, Ray, there is so much education coming down the pipe. I hope we can experience a shift, and I'm going to say thank you very, very much and just give your website once again, Ray, and I do hope that you'll come on and give us an update by the by.
Most definitely. Please invite me. There are developments that are taking place at a weekly basis here with our organization. And just for everyone, you don't need to formally register to go into the website. You only need to register to participate in the forum, the Experiencer Forum. And once again, this is a website not only for experiencers, but also individuals that want to learn about that phenomenon. For example, if you're an academic or a researcher or a scientist, and you might have had an inkling to dabble to investigate some of these areas, our website is a website that will be trying to explain this phenomenon in a very scientific, rational basis, but yet fully validating the complexities of experiences that all of us are having. And our website, once again, is experiencer.co.
Experiencer.co. Ray Hernandez, thank you so much. And thank you to Mary Rodwell, Christina Knowles, and I forgot the other person who's there as part of their pillars. And I really look forward to feeding in with you all. And for the Amash contact, it's the website is amash.co.uk. The email is amash@hotmail.co.uk. The Skype is amash2011, and Twitter is amashuk. Thank you very much, Vin. It's been amazing. And thank you to my two wonderful guests, and we'll be hearing from them again. And I know that we are going to go skyfalling with Adele. And thank you very much for listening to this show, and I hope that we've all learned something and that you find it interesting and that you develop a passion for education, as we all have in this field, about this incredibly important subject. Thanks again, Adele.
Hello, and welcome to a brand new Amash program. You're in for an interesting ride. This is the Amash Files. Hosted by PeoplesInternetRadio.com.